This Rock Talk podcast recording is an interview and opinion product that is the property of rocksubculture.com, all rights reserved. Rocksubculture.com is not responsible for any statements or opinions expressed by the guests of this program. Welcome to Rock Talk, the official podcast for rocksubculture.com. Each podcast features interviews with special guests to discuss all aspects of popular music. Rocksubculture.com travels the globe to experience, review, and archive live concert events. Interview those involved in producing and performing a variety of genres of popular rock music, as well as find and learn about related studio and stage-used artifacts and memorabilia. Now, let's join our host, Jason DeBoard.
Welcome to Rock Talk, and today my guest is Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. So I wanted to welcome you to the show, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
It's a pleasure, Jason. Thanks for inviting me.
So, you know, you're pretty famous as an 80s band, but you actually have a new album coming out today called Taser Up, and I wanted to talk to you about that first. So what inspired you to come together and make a new studio album?
Mainly, I guess the catalyst was a show that we did in Los Angeles back in 2006, I think it was, called Hit Me Baby One More Time, which was a so-called reality show.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how much reality there was in it. I suppose the reality was that you had to play one of your hits, and then you had to do a cover of a new song, and relatively new. In our case, we did a cover of Nelly's Hot in Here.
Uh-huh.
Which was very funny. It shocked a lot of people. But I think we did a really good version. In fact, there's talk about putting that out at some point. In fact, we should have put it out immediately, you know, but we're very slow English boys, you know.
Yeah.
So, but that was really the catalyst in the sense that Nick and I were together in Los Angeles meeting people who were all kind of starry-eyed about Wang Chung and offering us work. And so we kind of thought, yeah, we should do this. And I think, you know, Nick up until that time had been working for Sony and for Warner Brothers for quite a long time, but with the gradual shrinking demise, or whatever you want to call it, of the record labels, he was finding himself with more time on his hands. And I was up for doing more Wang Chunging. You know, I've sort of remained a sort of songwriter throughout all these years, and I've done various projects in the meantime as well. But so I guess that sort of latter part of the noughties, we had some time to devote to it. So we spent a bit of time thinking about what a Wang Chung album would be in the 21st century. So we sort of thought, well, you know, back then we had drum machines, synths, guitars and vocals, obviously. But we didn't have samplers, we didn't have drum loops, stuff like that. So we thought, well, we're going to kind of stay away from that, which we did for most of the tracks. There's a couple where we cheated. But a lot of the tracks try to use that 80s aesthetic, and we try and sort of mix the sort of classic Wang Chung sound with a kind of more modern approach.
Yeah, now I had a chance actually to listen to the new album over the last, I think, week and a half or so, and I have to say it's awesome. I love the album.
That's great.
I mean, even, you know, if I didn't know who Wang Chung was and wasn't, you know, familiar with your 80s work, I just found it to be just a great album, just standing alone on its own merits.
You know, I mean, we love it. I mean, obviously, we love it because we're putting it out.
Yeah.
It requires a bit of effort to do that, even these days, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it has, it's got some interesting songs on it, and it retains, like, I think, some essential Wang Chung characteristics. And but like I say, I think it also has some modernist stuff, in, you know, particularly in the production and so on. So, yeah, I'm glad you love it.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to know if we could just actually talk about each of the songs just a little bit, because
sure.
The one thing that struck me is that there's just a lot of variety between the songs.
Yeah.
And so the first one, City of Light, it just is a very kind of faster pop oriented, kind of electronic and catchy song. And I was wondering kind of what was the genesis behind that and sort of the writing process.
We worked with an engineer called Adam Wren, and Adam had worked with Left Field. He did their two sort of classic albums. And it was really the first day that I was working with him. I just came up with that guitar thing, you know, which is like kind of a sharp 11 chord.
Uh-huh.
If that means anything to you. We just kind of recorded the guitar track like in one take, and you know, that was the sort of basis of it. But I think what I've always loved the White Album by the Beatles.
Uh-huh.
I love Back in the USSR.
Yeah,
slightly Beach Boysy thing that it has to kick an album off. And I always heard City of Light as the opening track because of that sort of Beach Boys thing. I know we open with a remix of Dancehall Days, but that for me is just like a bit of context
before right.
we kick off with the real album.
Yeah, it's funny because actually listening to it, different songs, I got kind of a little bit of a Beatles, more okay. 60s kind of vibe.
Sure.
Yet
sure.
sort yeah, of you get the true. 80s too, and then you get more of the modern electronic music too.
Sure.
And then the second track, Let's Get Along, that to me, it feels more like kind of a singer-songwriter, more acoustic, just totally different kind of song. And it kind of builds up, but it still has sort of that stripped sound. So how is that for you doing that kind of a song?
When I was working on an album with a band called Arcana,
uh-huh.
a sort of English band that were, well, they had some hits in the late 90s, and I produced an album with them around that time, a sort of follow-up album, which sadly, for all sorts of political reasons, really didn't see the light of day, but it's a great record. And on the, one evening, Ollie J, who's the main man in that band, and I were sitting around, and I came up with the riff and sort of recorded it, and he came up with a sort of Let's Get Along type idea. And so it really sort of came out of there, that session. But also for me, I think the way that we use the production on it, I love that Blur song, you know, song two with it.
Yeah. Woo-hoo! Yeah, exactly.
And that sort of very beaten up acoustic sound to begin it, and then the way it all then sort of flowers into something quite different.
Yeah.
That was a sort of model in a way.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I love that song. And then yeah. Rent Free, I thought was a really cool song. That one, you've got that electronic guitar riff, and
yeah.
you have more of the 80s sounding keyboard synthesizer. And then it kind of strips down. And to me, it has sort of, it actually reminded me a little bit of the Pet Shop Boys in some ways. Again, it's kind of, it's a really interesting album because you've got all these different sorts of songs. I mean, yeah. a lot of albums, you know, song to song, it all sort of sounds the same. And this one, it's like there's that consistency throughout the album, yet
yeah.
the songs kind of each stand alone is yeah. a kind of sort of a different idea.
Well, I think, you know, back in the sort of 80s, but, you know, we were doing a similar thing, you know, growing up listening to Beatles records and, you know, records from the 60s and 70s, you know, bands used genre
mm-hmm.
as something they played around with, you know.
Right.
The sort of identity of the bands was really strong, but, you know, like on Sgt. Pepper, you know, Within You, Without You, Indian thing, followed by When I'm 64, which is like a 1920s pastiche, followed by Lovely Rita, which is like modern rock, you know, The Day in the Life, Lucy in the Sky, you know. The Beatles were the classic band for sort of hopping around in genres.
Uh-huh.
And that, to me, that's always what an album has been. You know, it's been the identity of the band, and then they're experimenting with all this different stuff. So I always wanted our album to be that. And I think back in the 80s, you know, we went from Dancehall Days, you know, to Live and Die in LA, which is obviously much darker and
right.
more serious in a way, and then to Everybody Have Fun, which is like very pop, you know.
Yeah.
So even then, we were kind of doing that. I think Geffen got a little confused about what sort of band we were. That's the downside of all that. But I think, you know, when you're, as an artist, you want to sort of try all these different things out, you know.
Yeah, and it's funny because my notes I took as I was listening to the album, it seemed like there were sort of these darker moments in the album and then these brighter spots. And the next song, Justify Your Tone, it starts out kind of minimalist and electronic. And to me, it actually had kind of a Trent Reznor sort of vibe to it. And again, it kind of goes into a nice acoustic guitar. And actually, that kind of made me think a little bit more of the Beatles again.
Yeah. That song is actually by another songwriter called Will Bates. And it was from a time when Nick was working for the record labels, you know, and I used to go and see him. I sort of say, so what's new, you know? And I remember one time he played me this song, Justify Your Tone, which I loved, you know, and he said, yeah, I knew you'd love that, but we're not signing in. And then he played me this horrible record by this guy called Him, you know, obviously been very successful at that. And then he said, yeah, we're signing them, you know, and I just thought, oh my God, you know, it's like, so, I just did this version of Justify Your Tone, and we sort of worked on it, probably, you know, 5 years of messing around with different approaches to it in a way. I mean, it was always the same approach, you know. Again, I love the fact that it has this very somber sort of opening section.
Right.
And then it goes into this very pop sort of readable chorus.
Yeah.
I love the lyrics in the song, you know.
Yeah, and you know, I've always liked music that goes through a lot of changes. Like, you know, New Order on the electronic side, and then like even the Pixies on the rock side. I get a lot of that from this album. Like it's really cool because it all kind of flows really nicely, but you know, it just works really well. I really like that about this album. Well,
that's great. I'm glad you can latch on to the thread of consistency that is running through it.
Yeah.
It appears like eclectic, to say the least.
Yeah, and then the next song is actually one of my favorite ones on the album, Driving You, which kind of opens with keyboards. And again, it sort of harkens back to that 80s sort of vibe, but it's just very uplifting. And to me, it sounds soundtrack-like. Like, I can sort of imagine, like, a coastal drive during the sunset or something. Okay. And
well, that's exactly what I was trying to sort of evoke, really. You know,
and I love that layered keyboard riff about a minute and a half in. And then you've got sort of another transition in about 2.5 minutes, and then you've got that really cool chorus and the drum beat, and I like how it bookends the sort of that keyboard sound at the beginning and the end. I just think it's just a really cool song.
Thanks very much. Yeah, well, I like that song. There's all sorts of musical things going on in that song that I like the verse through the chorus and through to the little bit that goes on the end of the chorus.
Yeah.
Just a descending C major scale in the bass, and I really like the kind of simplicity of that, if you like. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
And so I get all into these sort of musical things that are going on in the songs, you know, that are not necessarily on the surface sort of thing, but, you know, when bands come to like sit down and maybe figure that song out, if anybody ever did, you know, they're like, oh, God, yeah, I see what he's doing.
Yeah, it's really cool. And then the next song, Why, is...
Yeah.
That I thought was just cool because it's sort of got this funk R&B thing going on. It's just sort of such a happy, catchy song. And I wanted to ask you, are there female vocals in that, or is that?
Yeah,
there is. Okay,
this was a song that Nick and Adam were working on and off for ages, and Nick sampled the female vocal from some like sort of public, you know, rights free place. You know,
interesting.
But he had come up with that sort of the main guitar riff and. You know, had me singing over it, and you know, in a way, it's one of those songs where we never quite came up with the chorus, if you like. You know, but he was always kind of, oh no, this is good. People are going to get into this. You know? And I was like, no, we've got to write a proper song. We can't have this dance stuff. But he really fought his corner on that. So, but I love it. You know, and I think you know, having that element. You know, there's all sorts of tracks like "Don't Be My Enemy" off of "Points on the Curve" and you know, "Hypnotize Me" in a way off of "Mosaic." There's that sort of flirting with kind of funk that Wang Chung always had. You know, I never think we quite pulled it off, actually.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, Nick and I both had a big affection for, you know, Chaka Khan and that sort of American funk stuff that was, I think, very unfashionable in England, actually, at the time. But I think that's why we ended up signing to an American label, really, rather than based out of the UK.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So the next song, London Orbital, that's another one of my favorite ones on this album, and again it has that really 80s sort of opening, but I love the vocals. And you know, it's funny because the first time I listen to an album, I always try to take notes, because you know how you have that first impression that you sort of lose after you hear it a few more times. And it actually, there's an aspect to it. Do you remember the band the Beloved?
I don't know them actually, but I know the name.
Yeah, there's sort of this quality in your vocals in that reminds me a little bit of that guy, which, you know, most people don't even remember them, but I thought they were a cool band. But But I just really like how strong the sounds are in, in that song. And it's just such a clean, like everything really, the sounds really stand out. And it's just such a kind of cool and chill song. I just really, really like that one.
Thank you. Yeah. But I sort of came up with that riff, you know, because in a way, working with the software that you have these days, you know, back in the 80s, get hiring an Oberheim synth that would make those kind of sounds. Mm-hmm. Cost a fortune, or it was a fortune to buy. You know, it's actually much easier to make an 80s record now than it was in the 80s. You know, but I sort of found that sound and just came up with that riff. The sound sort of, you know, really just inspired the riff in a way. And it's a real homage to the 80s and to those electronic bands, you know, like New Order and Joy Division and stuff. You know, trying to sort of evoke that kind of atmosphere and. It came from a time when my daughter was at university and she was in Oxford, and it's kind of like meant driving around this thing called the M25. It's like a motorway that's like an orbital around London.
Yep.
You know, we used to drive up there on a Friday night and the traffic would be really heavy and it'd be raining and stuff. but there's a certain atmosphere and the way the lights would all sort of line up in front of you and be coming towards you and stuff. It was quite hypnotic in its way.
Yeah, cool. I've been to London a bunch of times. Like I can imagine what you're talking about and how it fits in with that song.
There's also a book called London Orbital by this guy called Ian Sinclair, who's quite an eccentric English writer, and he basically walked around the M25, but was looking at all these little, effectively these villages that were on the outskirts of London, because there's this whole thing that, you know, like London is so different from the rest of England, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People living within the M25, they're sort of safe. he's got a great angle on it all. So. But his book is called London Orbital, so I sort of slightly stole his title.
Cool.
I think you can do that.
So the song Abducted by the 80s, it's kind of opens a bit like spoken word poem or something, right?
Yeah.
So what kind of inspired you to, like, is that a reaction to something, or kind of what was your idea behind that song?
Well, without getting too detailed about it, I got really interested in Steve Reich's music over the last 15 years, really, sort of thing. But at that point, I was sort of experimenting with this kind of systemic thing, you know, how his music has all these contrapuntal lines at different levels, and then one line will move up by some increment, and then again. And so the surface of the music is that it stays the same and is very repetitive, but the reality is that it's constantly changing in this kaleidoscopic kind of way.
Mm.
And I was trying to do that electronically, and I sort of got this stuff going, and was then trying to sort of move it towards a song, but every time I put drums on it, it started to sound really cheesy and horrible. And then my daughter came back from university, and she had seen this guy called Rob G. Rob is a poet, kind of come stand-up comedian, I guess. And he was doing this stuff. And one of the poems he read was Abducted by the 80s. And she got a CD of it for me and was like, you're going to love this. And I played it and found it very funny, you know. But what I found was, you know, I just basically took his audio and laid it across the top of this track that I'd already written. And I found that what he said just sort of like dropped into it in a really sort of like synchronous kind of way. So I created this sort of quite long track where I used the whole of his poem, you know. And then when I played it to Nick, and it was like, oh man, this is great, but you need to turn this into a song, you know. So what you're hearing on the album is a sort of song version of it. On one of the EPs that we released last year, there's the full-length poem version.
Hmm.
And so, if you were interested, you should have a listen to that.
Yeah.
But the song version is probably the more accessible version of it.
Very interesting. Overwhelming feeling. That's kind of like a piano ballad. And again, it sort of has that transitions from, like, it starts out a bit sort of brighter and then it gets a little bit more somber, right?
Yeah, that's a sort of Wang Chung thing in a way.
Yeah.
I remember playing To Live and Die in L.A. to an A&R guy at Geffen, and I played him the sort of demo we've done, you know. And I could see him sort of like really perking up when it started up, with the heavy riff and the vocal and stuff. And then you have the chorus, you know, which is much more somber, you know. And
yeah.
People looked at him and went, it went down in the chorus. Yeah, it's sort of stuff, you know, and he goes, it shouldn't go down. And I was not into it. But, yeah, I guess I have a habit of going down in the chorus. But Overwhelming Feeling is actually a song that Nick and I sort of wrote half and half. It's usually he writes a song or I write a song, and we'll sort of like finesse it together.
Right.
But usually the core ideas come from one or other of us. But this one, Nick had come up with that main idea in the verse, and then I came up with the other stuff. So
cool.
It's quite nice that we, you know, actually finished the song together.
Yeah. So the last track on the album, Stargazing, I really like the opening's really cool. I really like the guitar riff, and the vocals are just so confident. It's just such a catchy song, like as soon as it starts going. But it's also the longest song on the album. I think it's almost 7.5 minutes. So what are your thoughts kind of on the length of song and sort of the choices? Like, did this song just feel like you really wanted to just kind of stretch it out and let it breathe, or is it...
I've always been a fan of long songs, actually. You know, I think growing up through the 70s, as I did, you know, I was used to Pink Floyd albums and where you had, you know, a song lasting for a side, or, you know, or a Genesis album, you know, where Supper's Ready lasts for the whole side. And I know it's made up of little sections, but, and with Stargazing, my sense was that, you know, it has these various musical ingredients in it, you know, the opening guitar riff, and then this sort of heavier kind of riff in D minor, and then there's a sort of like an arpeggio type idea, and the chorus, and basically all of the things are presented separately, and then they're all sort of played together for the outro section. And,
right.
So I kind of felt like, yeah, you need time to present all these ideas, and then you need time to combine them and stuff. So I kind of was arguably a bit self-indulgent, but I kind of feel, you know, what else are you going to do?
Yeah. Well, and it's really a great way to close out the album too.
Well, thanks. I kind of like as well, you know, that in the old days, there was always a sort of great track that was the end track, you know.
Yeah.
I think CD mentality, you know, became, you know, the tracks were like almost in order of importance, you know.
Uh-huh.
So by the time you were listening to the back end of the CD, it was all pretty ghastly, you know. Whereas, hopefully with this, you know, it's a collection of songs, each of which has a validity, and you know, that final track is, you know, kind of hopefully a bit of a high point.
Yeah. Now, you've been in the music industry for a long time, and obviously things have changed a lot in that time. What are your thoughts on just the concept of the album and how it exists today versus, you know, the 70s and the 80s and the 90s? I mean, we went from vinyl to CD, and now everything's electronic, and people are sort of just hunting out singles rather than getting that real album experience.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've talked about this to so many people, but I'm a huge believer in the album, you know, as the great way for an artist to present their work.
Right.
Now, I get that for a consumer, it's a different set of conditions, you know, and not everybody wants to sit down for 45 minutes and listen to, you know, a selection of songs and be considered in their responses and stuff. You know, some people just want the hit, you know, in the drug sense, you know. And, and that's kind of cool. You know, I think you have the option to do that. But I think all of these people who bang on online, you know, the album's dead and stuff, you know, they're really just looking at things down the wrong end of the telescope, I think. And, you know, sure, it seems like the album's dead, you know, if everything's got to be done from a consumer point of view.
Right.
But from an artist point of view, I think albums are very much alive and will always be, you know. And when an artist has got something to say, you know, you can't just say it in a encapsulated thing. I mean, maybe you can once or twice sort of thing, you know, perhaps those kind of classic songs that maybe sum them up, and maybe Wang Chung have done that, you know, Dance with Days or Everybody Has Fun, you know.
Right.
But in reality, you know, the nature of these bands is quite often in slightly more obscure tracks, and you know, almost everyone, you know, if you know, had a real fan of a band, you know, they're not going to be loving the number one hit. They love, you know, track 8 on the third album or something, you know. And
right.
So I think it's just that, you know, the album is will always be alive, I think. You know, I'm interested as well in the whole kind of, you know, was CD a major mistake? You know, Neil Young's kind of contention that, you know, digital was all just a big mistake.
Yeah. On the new album, you know, your voice sounds incredible. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on, you know, aging over the years and being a vocalist and, you know, how your voice changes and all that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the compliment. I think definitely I got more into singing in the last sort of 10 years or so. You know, back in the 80s, when you're young, you know, you just sort of do it.
Yeah.
And I never really considered it. And I never really considered myself a singer particularly. I did it because there was no one else to do it. And when I did have other people sing my songs, I never quite felt they captured it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, I probably am a better singer now than I was then. And I'm probably a better guitar player now than I was then.
Yeah.
Through having done a lot more work in the sort of jazz area and practiced a lot more. And I guess I'm probably, I think back in the 80s, you know, as a younger artist, you become quite insular. And especially when you start becoming successful, you start thinking, yeah, I know how this works, you know. But in reality, you don't. Really, you need to be listening to stuff and really getting the, you know, the great artists, you know, the Dylans and the, listening to Elvis and stuff. I remember, you know, really getting into Elvis around 2000, and particularly when I visited Graceland in 2008, and you know how he sings and the expressiveness in his voice, and you know, so yeah, I've really worked on my singing a bit. I actually took some lessons as well, you know. But for me, music is constantly this thing where you're a student, and you're always, well, there's that little bit in Abducted by the 80s when I sing, you listen and you get it somehow, and that for me is what music is about, you know. Listen and you get it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the 80s, you know, you had a pretty big imprint on pop culture. Like, you know, there's that sequence in that Cheers episode with Frasier talking about everybody Wang Chung tonight.
One of my favorite things, yeah.
And the Breakfast Club, the Fire in the Twilight sequence there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one of the biggest shows on TV now is The Walking Dead. And, and you had a song in the very first episode. So what is it like to sort of have your work kind of intertwined in big pop culture moments, you know?
I mean, it's fabulous, and it's very sort of sought out by us, if you know what I mean.
Right.
I think it's fair to say, you know like the space junk in The Walking Dead, you know, that Frank Darabont was a big fan of that song and just always wanted it to be the closing music of the first episode of The Walking Dead, as I've been told by people, you know. And it's an obscure little track that was on a greatest hits compilation that we did back in 97. So things like that are just very gratifying, you know, that somebody of his stature, you know, kind of listening to music and of all the billions of possibilities, you know, alights on that as what he wants, you know. So it's there's nothing more sort of inspiring and kind of gratifying than you know, having your peers take your work and run with it, you know.
So yeah.
It's great feeling.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because if you actually go onto iTunes and you pull up that Greatest Hits album, you know, they always have the little popularity rank to the right. And that track actually shows as the most popular, even, you know, over the biggest hits you've had, which is funny because it just shows that, you know, this music can be out there sort of undiscovered. And then all of a sudden people trip over it and love it. So, you know, even if immediately it's not a big hit, I guess there's always that potential that there can be sort of this resurgent interest in a song, you know?
Yeah. I think we've experienced that with To Live and Die in LA to a certain extent, in that, you know, we did the first album with Dance All Days on it, or technically our second album, and you know, that was a big pop hit, and then when we did To Live and Die in LA, Geffen were, you know, not super impressed that we wanted to do a movie soundtrack, and then they grudgingly let us put it out as a second album, and of course it didn't have a big pop hit on it, and so purely from a sort of accountancy point of view, it was regarded as a flop, you know.
Yeah.
And there was then a lot of pressure on us, you know, to have that top 10 hit, which we obliged, you know, with Everybody Has Fun Tonight. But it is To Live and Die in LA has sold steadily over the years and is the more successful sort of artistic statement, I think, you know, of all of our albums.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to sound too sanctimonious, but, you know, I think if you do the stuff you believe in and you kind of just keep standing by it, you know, although there's pressures to, you know, do other stuff, go for the fast buck or, you know, the mass appeal or whatever. I mean, I think you have to cover all the bases, but I think as long as you keep in focus, that sort of identity and your strengths and stuff, that keeps you going as an artist, I think.
Yeah.
I do sound pretentious.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of saying it for, you know, bands who, you know, maybe sort of think, oh, God, you know, maybe we should just be more generic or something. But no, it's right. Like, always do your thing.
Yeah. Now, you've had a very collaborative musical career. Is there anyone alive today that you, is there one particular person you'd love to work on a project with or do a song with or something?
I'm a big fan of John Hopkins, actually. I know his work. But he's a sort of like, I guess maybe known more as a producer in some ways, but he did an album called Inside. Probably came out a couple of years ago now. But I really love his work. He'd be someone I'd be very interested to work with.
Cool. Now, are you planning to tour in 2013?
There's definitely a plan. Does it make sense?
Cool.
to tour in the summer. You know, it just makes sense for all sorts of reasons for it to be the summer.
Yeah.
And we're working on that as we speak. We have an agency and some good guys managing us these days, and I hope that we'll be able to pull together a tour. You know, that includes some fairs and festivals, and hopefully we can play in the major cities. Some way, you know, and people can come and hear this new stuff played live. You know, that's really pretty exciting. And I think Wang Chung as a live band is probably certainly better than it ever was. I think. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. I just wanted to let you know, "Dance Hall Days" is like one of my all-time favorite songs of any decade or era, and cool. It's been a real honor to talk to you, and hopefully I'll catch you at one of these live shows next year.
Just let us know if you can make it, and I really appreciate you listening to the album and, you know, having the attention to detail with it all. It's great.
Oh yeah, it's fantastic. I can't recommend it enough. People go check it out. So anyway, thanks for talking with me today, and good luck with the album, and hopefully I'll get an opportunity to see you guys live next year.
I really hope. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to our program, Rock Talk. For the latest gig archives, articles, and features about popular music and concert events around the world, please visit us online at www.rocksubculture.com.
Even say Moose Busters.